Hey, everybody, welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. We got a lot to unpack today, got a lot of stuff here with Matt Kachansky. As everybody knows, Matt, retired special agent in charge from the OIG and the Northeast UPIC director, and now our payment integrity director, overseeing all of our special investigation and payment integrity contracts. And one of his right-hand guys, Wade McFaul, depends who you're talking to, I guess, or what part of the country you are, retired assistant special agent in charge and a manager on our SIU investigative team. And so we want to talk today. First of all, I'm really impressed the fact that we all got the proper memo about wearing advised shirts and in different colors. So that's nice to see. I appreciate that. So we want to talk, you know, obviously, there's a lot of anarchy going on in healthcare fraud, waste, and abuse. We will call it fraud, waste, and abuse, FWA. For some reason, people are now calling it waste, fraud, and abuse, but it's FWA as we all know it. We all know there's a lot of anarchy going on right now in government about, you know, where they're calling things fraud, waste, abuse. People are using the F word really loosely. And for those of you in the space or those of you that have an interest in the space know that it's not really a loose term. You can't really characterize something as fraud when it's not really fraud. There are mistakes in the healthcare billing, coding, and documentation space, and there's intentional things. And fraud is really the intentional thing, and the waste and abuse are not necessarily intentional as far as the commission of the crime. And so we want to just kind of talk about that. We want to focus today really on these three letters. We want to kind of help to clarify some of these things because, you know, when you start to see a lot of these potentially identified areas of fraud, waste, or abuse, and they're put into this kind of general bucket, the very first thing is people should go to jail. People should go to jail. And not everything is fraud. Not everything is waste. Not everything is abuse. And sometimes it is just because the people that are looking at the thing, whatever it may be, have a kind of a myopic view or kind of just this very narrowed view. And we want to kind of put some clarity on that. And so, you know, the first thing that comes to mind, Wade, from an investigator's perspective, from a manager's perspective, is that investigators aren't really in a position to start to make determinations about whether something is in fact, fraud, waste, or abuse. Investigators do their thing, and it's up to someone else, right? And the problem is that sometimes you can really get bogged down in trying to determine whether something is one or the other or the other.
Yeah, we don't necessarily, like you say, we don't assign it a letter, whether it be fraud, waste, or abuse. But we do, as the investigation plays out, it's going to become apparent to the investigator kind of what categories it's likely to fall in. And we will kind of steer the investigation depending on that. And that, a lot of that, as you said, has to do with, a couple different things, levels of like egregiousness, different levels of intent that you might be able to prove or not prove. You know, you look at cases or referrals or whether they're spinoff investigations that come in and they kind of go on a continuum of, as you were saying, like the waste and abuse, which is less egregious. So there's not as much intent or any intent. And these are things like coding errors where it might be like a 99213 versus a 99214. Where it's very subjective, you know, this is not going to most likely turn into a fraud case. You got medical necessity issues. We can go through the laundry list of different types of cases or allegations in referrals and kind of categorize them as fraud, waste, or abuse based on egregiousness, intent, and those types of things. But a lot of it, and we've talked about this, we've at least touched on this on a number of recent podcast, it always comes up because it's one of the main issues is, can you prove, is there intent and can you prove intent? And how are you going to prove intent? And that's what the fraud cases boil down to. You know, there's different ways. You basically have to get into the providers or the case, the subject of the case, get into their mind as to what their frame of mind was when they were doing whatever this activity is. Were they cognizant that it was illegal? Did they do things to avoid detection? Did they do things like, did they talk to people about, you know, how to respond if the feds come, you know, those types of things to cover up, which can lead to showing their mindset at the time. They knew it was illegal, and that is one of those things that brings it into the fraud arena as opposed to the waste or abuse. And even in those cases, like the if an OIG agent is looking at a referral and they're not necessarily assigning it a fraud, waste, or abuse, but the circumstances are leading it to where it's more of a waste or abuse case, it's not something they're going to invest really any resources into. That's not actually true. It's something that's more likely to be referred to another, you know, to the carrier, to the UPIC, the ZPIC, whoever, the Mifuku. It's not something that they're going to work criminally, possibly civilly. But you're looking for things to bring it into that fraud arena, like, you know, comments like, you know, where it shows that the person knew that it was illegal and they went to do it anyways. And it brings back the case we talked about last week on the skin grafts, where the salespeople were told you will use a 4x6 inch skin graft regardless of the size of the wound. That's great evidence to show intent. You're not ordering a bigger skin graft because you want to make sure that smaller wound is covered. You're doing it for the money. So those types of comments are important in taking it from the fraud, or I mean from the waste and abuse to the fraud.
Right. I mean, what you're really talking about, Wade, to an extent, is kind of the overt signs that someone is intent on committing fraud, right? Like if we're talking about a case involving services not rendered, and they've billed for something and there's no documentation and the provider was out of town, or in the SIU space, we do some interviews. The member says, no, I didn't go that day. How do you know you didn't go that day? Well, I have a calendar I keep and I was, you know, at Disney with my family or whatever it would be, right? Where there's some obvious ones. I think where it suddenly gets a little bit more murky are on these instances where a service was actually rendered, an item service procedure was provided, and there's some documentation, and you've got kind of these, right, these lines. And, you know, what you're really doing is you're kind of parsing out like, hey, there was a service rendered here. And so this could fall into that waste abuse, but it turns the corner when you've got people acknowledging, no, do it this way. And that's where that line of demarcation is. But in the general sense, from that SIU investigator's perspective, finding those lines of demarcation can be a challenge.
Right. And in the SIU world, it's kind of almost the opposite of the OIG world, where you'll get an allegation. And if, you know, they typically, if you're trying to put it into one of those categories, in the SIU world, if it turns into, we think this is fraud, you're likely going to refer it on to the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit or some other law enforcement agency, because SIUs by their nature are really not set up to work criminal fraud cases. So if we determine that there is fraud, we file a credible allegation of fraud and refer it to an agency that's more capable of working it, which is kind of the opposite. Whereas if the OIG finds something that's, maybe this is something that we should just collect an overpayment, educate them and move on, that's more of an SIU world thing. And I just got a call from an OIG agent a couple of days ago. One of the cases that we had worked, it was a very small dollar amount case, but we sent an overpayment letter and we sent educational materials as to why they were billing incorrectly. And from the SIU perspective, it wasn't, you know, it was a couple thousand dollar cases, very small compared to OIG. But the OIG agent was calling me and like thanking me because that little bit of education that we provided now kind of bridges that intent piece for their criminal case. Because they can say, look, you got this educational letter from an SIU and it explains exactly how you did it wrong. And it told you what you
did
wrong.
That's exactly the point. That's exactly the point.
Intent.
And that's why the education piece to a provider is key. Because when you can go back and show that a provider has previously been admonished or educated about something and disregarded it. We're not talking about whether the provider agrees or disagrees with the education, because that's a different metric, right, about that. But that's a key point. And that really does show, you know, particularly, and I know we've talked about this from the SIU investigative perspective, is is the provider that's on your radar a repeat offender, right? Have you had prior interaction with them? And does that lead you to showing that there is, you know, that piece of the intent? And so, not to cut you off, Wade, but Matt, it kind of does, it kind of really does parlay. This is why we don't do this scripted, but it always works out well because apparently we each have one third of a brain. Mine is black, Wade's is maroon, and Matt's is gray like his hair. But Matt, it does get to this point of why you need to have both a thoroughly and well-documented case. And I know we really didn't talk about bringing this into the fold for today's discussion, but it certainly does lend itself to the importance of having a well-documented case. But it also lends to the more global piece, which is you've got to know when to hold them and you got to know when to fold them, right? A general SIU investigator, unless there's something that stands out as an obvious of a fraud perspective, you know, we're not really in positions in our current jobs to have discussions about is this fraud, waste, or abuse, because some of those are legal conclusions, they're regulatory conclusions, they're business decisions. But, you know, having a well-documented case to be able to pitch, hey, I think this fits into the fraud category because, hey, this provider's been previously educated. There's some outstanding issue. But part of this is, at the end of the day, it becomes part of the workflow and the management of an individual's caseload. And from a leadership perspective, it's proper resource allocation.
Right. Yeah. Wade mentioned resources. You mentioned resources. And that is the bottom line for any SIU is they have a finite number of resources and an infinite number of cases that they can work. So they need to set up policies, procedures, thresholds, criteria for what they should open as a lead to begin with. Is there a dollar threshold? Is there other factors that should be taken into account to even open a case? And one of the things that, you know, Wade talked about are the referrals going to law enforcement and them sending them back and things like that. One of the things you have to do as an SIU is communicate and coordinate internally and externally to figure out what are the issues of priority within the plan. What are the vulnerabilities? What are the big codes or services that are being, that are big dollar amounts and vulnerable to fraud, waste, or abuse in those things, as well as what's of interest to the OIG in that particular judicial district or local law enforcement or state law enforcement? What are the issues that if you come across data or a complaint that deals with this, this is something we may be interested in, and make this communication, you know, a dialogue that, you know, it's not just once a year, it's as these cases progress. This is what we're finding. Is this something you're interested in? Should we be working this up for a referral? Not taking a direction from law enforcement, but knowing that this is something that has the potential of getting referred for something that could be done judicially. And the other thing is, you know, having internal policies on what steps do you take in an investigation based on the facts of the investigation? What are the resources you can use? You don't want to go in and do on-sites on every case. You know, are some worthy of just doing telephonic interviews, if that, or some just data-based and just looking at this, you understand this is an education issue, send out a letter. Have those policies and those procedures in place to best utilize the resources that you have as an SIU. And the last thing I'll talk about is, you know, proactive versus reactive. You know, if an SIU is just getting complaint from 15 different sources, whether that's enrollment or other parts of the plan or from a member hotline, you're probably not utilizing your resources the best way. Those should be part of the queue, should be part of the thing. But most of your work, at least a majority of your work, should be data-driven analytics based on the known priority issues internally and with your external stakeholder partners. So your cases that you're working are hitting on those issues and not just ad hoc, complaint by complaint, claim by claim. That's a misuse of resources.
You know, it's interesting. When you read a lot of the press releases that get put out by the U.S. Attorney's offices or state AG's offices on healthcare fraud, waste, and abuse, and we read these press releases and you read what the facts are that they're putting in the press release, which is typically, you know, just public information where you see a provider who's resolved their case civilly for $10 million for something. And you read the facts and, you know, we read these. And the very first thing when I read them is I go, man, what was missing to have made this a civil case versus a criminal case? Right. We read these press releases all the time and opine on them constantly. And the one thing that always gets the feedback I get constantly on LinkedIn and emails is, why do I think this was done as a civil case versus a criminal case? And the answer I have to give is, I don't know, right? Because you don't know what underlying facts are. But also the thing that I certainly know is the case, because we've all experienced it, is the game of horse trading, where the U.S. Attorney's Office will look to pursue a case civilly versus criminally on something where maybe there's a larger amount of money, or a global resolution where if it's $10 million in fraud, 500 of it is criminal and, you know, 9,500 is civil to limit the exposure on that. But, you know, I think when we look at these press releases, we have to take them with a very strong grain of salt. We don't know what many of the underlying facts were that got to that resolution that made something civil. And we're not talking, you know, like in criminal case, right? They've obviously determined that there was an intent issue or what have you. It's in the civil context where people often wonder, like, what's going on? And, you know, there's a recent Supreme Court decision, I believe it is, where they talked about the subjective understanding of the provider from a false claims perspective. So, you know, the challenge is we got to climb inside of the provider's head to understand what their subjective understanding is. Now, you know, where we're going to see some of that is going to be when we see these cases that involve LCDs, local coverage determinations, over an NCD, national coverage decision, because those are subject to interpretation. And, you know, they are not considered to be regulatory in nature because they're not subject to the 60-day comment period and all of that. And I don't want to get into a deep dive about that, but that becomes part of the metric of understanding whether something is going to be criminal or civil, if there's, you know, differing policies out there or things of that sort. But I think that that's from an investigator's perspective, that's getting into the weeds of the investigation. But we oftentimes see these cases where when we, so, you know, definitively we can tell, you know, tell our viewers, our listeners, that when a case is resolved civilly, the U.S. Attorney's Office has identified that this is a WA case. It's a waste abuse case. It is not an F case. You may want to call it a fraud case, and it's going to fall under the False Claims Act, and there's language about falsity and fraudulent. But at the end of the day, part of the definition of fraud is the intent. And if you can show intent, then you have the crux of a healthcare fraud from the criminal statute. In the civil context, it's more of the WA. Ultimately, those are legal decisions that are made by the people on the prosecutor's side. It's not really, you know, for us. And you don't want to get too deep into the weeds from an investigator's perspective about whether this is an FW or an A case. And so, Wade, I want to give you kind of the last hurrah on this, because sometimes the challenge is knowing when to put your pencil down. Right. At what point do you say, I've interviewed 10 people and they're all saying this? Your investigator mind is saying, I think there's more. I think there's more. But, you know, oftentimes SIUs, you know, well, not oftentimes, SIUs don't have subpoena authority. SIUs don't have the ability to command testimony through depositions or interrogatories. Those things come about after a suit is potentially filed by the plan against the provider, right? You could then have depositions and interrogatories. But from the investigator's perspective, those things don't exist. And the biggest challenge is letting go, right? Investigators, we don't ever want to let go. How do you kind of come to that realization that it's time to move on?
Well, I think... just prior to getting to that point, I think there's a lot of I don't want to say like Hail Marys, but oftentimes you need to, when you can't nail down that intent piece, you need to have something that the provider or the subject said, like when their guard was down, whether that be and you know, ultimately it's easiest if it's some kind of something they documented, an email, a letter, something of that nature. But if you can't find that, and you need to have them say something like when their guard is down, to, you know, talk about how we don't want to talk to the feds about, you know, things of that nature that indicate that they know that it's wrong. So you can try those types of things, consensual monitorings, undercovers. If you're a good interviewer, you can talk to them about the subject and really get into the weeds and try and get them to contradict themselves and things of that nature. But to answer your question, when you get to that point where you just cannot nail down that intent piece, you have to move on. You have to, you know, a case that, as you said, may intend it to be a criminal fraud case the whole time, but if you just can't make that, you have to look at the different levels of burden of proof. If it's like, we're not going to get there. So you can take those same circumstances and work it as a civil case. And in many cases, there might be circumstances that are different, but if you can't get to that burden of proof of beyond a reasonable doubt because of this intent issue, you can get, you know, the preponderance of an evidence or preponderance of evidence for a civil case, you can still get that civil judgment, as opposed to
right.
What criminal investigators always want is the criminal stat, but a civil judgment is, you know, probably the next best thing. And some might argue it may even have more more deterrent effect, hit them in the pocketbook, as opposed to, you know, depending on which district it is, they might do a couple months and be out on the street. Whereas if you hit them in the pocketbook with a civil case, you might have done more in the long run to deter actually.
Right.
Throw on top of that is...
Okay, Matt.
In terms of when to call it quits, some SIUs, including at the UPIC, yeah, there's a time limit, 6 months from lead to resolution, to decision making. So you can build that in. Again, it's resource intensive, and you have to pick the right cases to be able to work them in 6 months. And then what we do in the SIU, and what a lot of the states are requiring for their Medicaid plans, is prior to taking any informal action by the plan, referrals are made to the state. For New York, OMIG. To Nebraska, it's the state of Nebraska. To get approval to take any administrative action, because they're making the determination whether it was fraud, waste, or abuse.
Right. Well, and you guys know that the biggest challenge with having to do those coordinations is that oftentimes those cases then sit with those regulatory or law enforcement organizations until a determination is made, and then they send it back. And you're running out of time based upon either a contractual ability, a statute, or something like that. And so, you know, you have to make these decisions sooner than later and hope that you get a response back sooner than later. So, yeah, I mean, these timeframes become very tight. 6 months is not a lot of time from beginning to end in some cases, particularly if you have an instance where a provider is reluctant to submit their records or submit complete records. And, you know, at some point we're going to have a more fulsome conversation about record requests. I think we need to have that conversation about when you are requesting records from providers, how to best target those requests, whether it be probe sampling, statistical sampling, but also the importance of attestations and things of that sort. So, you know, that's a conversation for another day. But I think it's very important, you know, kind of to close out this conversation, that as in the SIU space, it's less about identifying whether something is an F, a W, or an A versus, hey, Houston, we have a problem, and let's get some opinions about where this might fall, and then figure that out. You know, I mean, unfortunately, I think with what's going on today in government, the FWA letters, which are all being interchanged into WFA or AWF or whatever your, you know, Scrabble letters are, the problem is that everybody is hearing this and everybody is knee-jerk reactioning that it's fraud, everybody should go to jail. And in a lot of cases, it's not necessarily a fraud case. It may not even be a waste or abuse case. You know, we don't know. I mean, a lot of this is just subject to interpretation. But from our perspective, you know, we're taking actionable intelligence. We're creating a work plan, creating an investigative plan, coming up with findings, and then reporting those findings as appropriate. And then it's up to someone other than us. Because making determinations about whether something is an F, a W, or an A is largely the understanding of the legal definition and how those facts feel that they're supported for that. So for those of you in the space, just keep doing your thing. Think less about the letters FWA and just think more about doing the work that you're supposed to be doing and following your, you know, your internal policy. So, you know, strap in. It's like a roller coaster at any given time. The road will change and the path will change. So we just have to stay the course. As always, it's good to see you guys. Good to hang out with you for a little bit. It's nice to see that we wore our Alvin and the Chipmunk shirts together. That was a positive. And again, as always, we thank everybody for tuning in to our weekly OIG roundtable. We appreciate everybody who tuned into our recent LinkedIn Live on hospice fraud. We look forward to having you on future LinkedIn Lives as participants. Keep sending off those questions, comments, and concerns on LinkedIn and to our email. Again, you can get us a weekly email. We'll get you your podcast. We'll get you everything that you need in the newsletter. Advise, ADVIZE, health.com. And until next time, we'll see you next week on the next OIG Roundtable. Have a good one, everyone.
Thank you all.
Thank you.